Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today. For this week's episode, I am joined by David Carpenter, who you may know is a writer for Forbes magazine, and he's received some bit of notice within the broader 5-MeO-DMT community as he has made it a practice of regularly writing about 5-MeO-DMT for Forbes magazine. That's right. He actually got started writing about cannabis and got interested in MDMA and 5-MeO, and we're going to talk all about it in today's interview. We just finished up a great discussion, and I'm really happy to bring it to you here today. But first, let's make a few announcements. Would like to thank George for making a very generous contribution to the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, and also Brooke and James for making their monthly contributions. If you would like to support this podcast, it's quite easy. Just go by my personal webpage, www.martinball.net, and use the PayPal link at the top right of the page. Or, as I always mention, you can become a monthly supporter over at patreon.com/martinwball, and also be a monthly contributor there at the level that is most comfortable for you, from $1 a month up to $100 a month, with increasing access and benefits and gifts as you go up the scale. So that, of course, is always available. And as I like to mention, of course, I am available for consultations. If you would like to talk about your psychedelic experience or your work with 5-MeO-DMT, just reach out. My website for consultations is www.nondualentheogenicintegration.com. Just to let you know about what's going to be coming up in the coming weeks here on the podcast, I do have a number of other great interviews lined up. I actually already just completed an interview with George Lake, who is a lawyer and author of a book about entheogenic churches in the United States and the law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and what you can do to set up a religiously protected church. We had that conversation yesterday. It'll be out here on the podcast in just a couple weeks. Also coming up on the podcast, I have a forthcoming interview with Laura Dawn, and she runs the Psychedelic Leadership Podcast. So looking forward to talking to her in the next couple weeks. And of course, as I've also already mentioned, going to be having Jeremy Narby on this show very soon. So these are all things that we can look forward to in the coming weeks, as well as wrapping up, sharing selections from the audiobook of my memoir, Being Infinite. We just have one more chapter plus the epilogue to go. And then I think after that, I think I might start sharing chapters from my very first book and my first novel, Orbi's Vision, which is already available in audiobook. So that will be interspersed with all the many wonderful interviews that will be coming your way. I hope your summer is going well so far, or your winter, depending on where you are in the world. Here in Ashland, Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest, as I'm sure many of you are aware, we've been suffering from really out-of-control temperatures, and it's been very hot. Unfortunately, just was reading yesterday that something like 1 billion sea creatures died in our most recent heat wave because it was too hot along the coast. So mussels and anemones and sea stars pretty much boiled. They baked. Climate change is real, folks. Yeah, and right now it's super smoky outside. There's a massive wildfire just north of here, and the smoke is blowing over the mountains. So, you know, it's going to be another one of those summers here in the Pacific Northwest where it's getting drier and hotter and much, much, much smokier. And it's not just because we've legalized cannabis. It's because of the forest fires. So anyway, I hope you're well wherever you are. And let's go ahead and get into our conversation with David Carpenter, writer for Forbes magazine, of all places. And we're going to talk all about it right here, right now, on the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. Hope you enjoy. Well, you ready to get into it?
Sure.
All right. Well, man, there's so many things we can talk about today, Dave. I've got your book open right here, which you were very gracious to send me, the one, the first in your series. And I want to hear all about the series. We've got Your Neighbors Are Doing Psychedelics, MDMA. And of course, we've got to talk about Forbes magazine and writing about psychedelics for Forbes. And I've got a lot of questions I want to ask about that. But first, okay. I always like to start with kind of getting to know my guests. And so just want to invite you to tell us a little bit about your story, and also knowing that since you've been writing a lot about 5-MeO-DMT for Forbes, and a lot of the listeners of my podcast listen because I spend so much time talking about it and interviewing people about 5-MeO-DMT, I'm going to imagine that probably most of my listeners have read at least one of your articles. So they probably all know who you are at that level. But let's get to know Dave the person.
Okay, good. Yeah. That's a little bit shocking to me that people would know me, because I feel kind of isolated in some ways writing about this topic. So let me kind of back up to how I started. About 7 years ago, I was writing about cannabis when California was close to becoming legal, and, you know, Colorado and Washington had become legal, and found my way into a job with Cannabis Now magazine. Are you familiar with them?
I believe I've seen them. Yeah.
They're out of Berkeley. Really great magazine. I mean, they cover culture and, you know, the science and medical. They really hit like a wide swath. So I was the managing editor there for a few years and really enjoyed that, and kind of started to see that the conversation, of course, was moving from, you know, kind of like the high times, you know, so-called stoner culture, into kind of medical use, of course. And it was kind of this, you know, you tell people you had a medical card or you went to a dispensary, and they'd be like, oh, ho, you know, medical card, like, sure, you've got back problems or whatever.
And
I remember having a turning point with a person that I had just met who was in his 60s, and he was heading out on a bike ride. A real, you know, awesome guy. He was a school teacher for many years. Total upstanding dude. And he lit up a joint before he went on this like 40-mile bike ride. And he just mentioned to me that's for his back. You know, I do this for my back. And he's kind of a fun dude, so I sort of like laughed it off. And later he was telling me, no, seriously, I do this for my back. You know, like it helps to loosen me up. So that was like a big turning point for me. And that actually conversation with that guy was like 10 years ago, which got me really interested to looking at cannabis in a different way. So the second thing that really moved me towards this idea of healing yourself using cannabis and other drugs was a story that I did. I went for about a week out to Kentucky and interviewed hemp farmers in about 2016-17. And there were all these, you know, total straight edge people in Kentucky that were now growing cannabis for sort of the first time, some of these people. And I met some farmers who had just started, and others that were like fifth generation, you know, like 150 years back, some of them, that their families were growing hemp. And it got halted, of course, through like the drug war period. And I wrote a story about CBD and how it was, you know, coming onto the scene, and people just went crazy for it. They really loved this idea of CBD. And this was before CBD had really, you know, been like this tidal wave. So that really got me into kind of like the healing side of, you know, these different plant medicines, and, you know, opened me up to the idea that everything from, you know, LSD to DMT, psilocybin, really has a place. That kind of what got me is what got me started. I don't want to just keep going on. So if you have a question, I'll pause there.
No, actually, I have my own sort of medical cannabis story, that when medical cannabis was legalized in California, I was really disappointed that they didn't include asthma on there. Because something that I discovered as a teenager, I had really bad seasonal allergies, and I used to get just really horrendous asthma. I mean, to the point where I'd be in the bathroom, like choking, you know, and actually vomiting up phlegm and just completely panicking and unable to breathe. And then I had like all these little inhalers, right? You got to like squirt the little inhaler, and I took all these medications and I never liked any of them, and they never seemed to help. And then one day I was having an asthma attack, and I took a hit off a pipe with some cannabis, and it immediately cleared my lungs and I was able to breathe. And after that, I never took any asthma medicine again. And fortunately, I'm not bothered by asthma today. It could be because I use cannabis daily. You never know. But that for me, that was really profound, that it was like, wow, here's this really simple, natural remedy.
I don't have to have a prescription for it. I don't have to take some weird pharmacological drugs or anything. Just take one hit and my lungs clear up immediately.
Right. And it's something you could grow in your backyard, right? And have total access to it. And, you know, I think the idea, the kind of counterintuitive logic of smoking something to heal your lungs is for a lot of people really hard to accept. But
yeah.
I think it's a bronchodilator. Is that what they call it? So
yeah.
kind of opens up your lungs so you can breathe. So I got started with all of this through cannabis, which I think I heard on one of your shows that cannabis is the foothills of psychedelics. I remember a guy saying, that stuck with me, you know, that when used correctly, you could get a little taste of what you feel in the psychedelic experience. You know, there's a psychoactive quality there if you use it correctly, or, you know, if you're lucky or whatever. So from writing about cannabis, I found myself being interested in, you know, like I said, all these other drugs, and started writing for Forbes about cannabis and was finding some success there. The way that I knew I was finding success was they have a counter on each of the stories where you can see the number of views. So you know exactly how many people are reading your stories at all times. Which is pretty powerful for a writer.
Yeah.
You know, you really can feel that impact. So I wrote a few stories for Forbes, and the very first one I wrote was about a guy who made pipes in the shape of Dunkin' Donuts. And I remember overnight that got like 3,000 hits, and I was like, wow, this is amazing. So I kind of got hooked on writing for Forbes.
But Dave, let me just interrupt you there and ask you. So I don't know a whole lot about – I know more about Forbes magazine through your writing than I ever have because I never paid attention to Forbes. I mean, all that I've really known about Forbes is like the Fortune 500, and for me, this it's like a financial magazine. So how did you originally pitch this to them? Was it, well, cannabis is becoming a new industry and there's been a lot of money invested, so we need to be writing about it? Or how did you sell them on the idea, or did they sell you on the idea?
No, that's exactly how it happened. I went through one of my writers that I worked with at Cannabis Now, who was working for Forbes, and I noticed he had some stories popping up about cannabis. He also wrote for High Times, really great writer. And I said, hey, you know, do they need any other writers there? And he said, call my editor and see, I'll put in a word for you. So I called them, and immediately they just took a look at my resume, took a look at a few of my stories, and they were like, you want to write about CBD? Let's pull you on. So I started writing about CBD, or, you know, that was the plan anyway. But I just kind of went for it and started writing about anything that was connected to cannabis. And they were really excited about it because I would typically get, you know, 10,000, 20,000 views pretty much out the gates with my stories. And it's all about views for them, right? It's like if they every time someone reads it, that's a potential ad. So they have since, you know, there's got to be a stable of a good 20 or 30 specifically cannabis writers that are covering that beat for Forbes, which, you know, shocked me too.
Yeah. I mean, it just shows how far things have come. When I was a teenager and getting interested in cannabis, the only magazine was, as you say, High Times, and you get your, you know, your cannabis centerfold, right? That you pull down, look at those buds. And, you know, then to have a mainstream financial institution like Forbes say, we want to bring this on. We want stories on this. I mean, it makes sense in the internet age that you want stories that are going to be getting clicks and getting views. But even that there's an acceptance there within that mainstream form of media to acknowledge that, look, this is a big enough topic that even though it's been sort of taboo in the past, that let's bring in a whole team of writers to write about it, because this is how the landscape is changing.
That's right. Yeah, they could really see that, you know, dominoes were falling state one by one. We're, you know, going full, you know, recreational, legal, and medical. So it's just in their interest to do this, to write about it more. And you could see at maybe 2016 or so, it went from millions to billions. You know, I think it was a canopy growth. There was like that $4.5 billion deal with the makers of Corona beer and Modelo. And that was just, that was like a hockey stick up. You could just see that they were like, more stories, the better. Keep bringing in stories like this. So yeah, I got my start there with cannabis. And there was a kind of turning point in 2018 with Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, of course, and Mike Tyson talking on the Joe Rogan show mm-hmm. about doing toad.
Yeah.
And I think I mentioned to you this before, these were like two things that kind of coincided within about a month for me or something like that. And at roughly the same time, I had just gone to see the premiere of the movie Fantastic Fungi. Mm-hmm. It was just premiering at the San Francisco, the Castro Theater in San Francisco. Paul Stamets was speaking there. The director of the film was there. And all of these things were kind of swimming around in my head. Like, you know, I'm already writing about this psychoactive substance. Like, you know, I wonder, do I start pointing in that direction? And actually, it was my girlfriend, and she's going to love that I added that in right there, that said, you need to write a review on this film for Forbes and just get in there, you know, get into the expansion to psychoactive drugs. And I said, no way. And I was in a, you know, a little bit of a pissy mood about it. And I was like, you're crazy. You don't know anything about writing or media. You know, she's an event planner, but she's savvy about a lot of things that I'm not. So by the end of the movie, when they were doing the Q&A, I was like, I could write a story about this. I could for sure write a story about this. So the next day I pitched it to one of my editors. She ran it up to the lead editor of what's called the Vices section at Forbes. And he said, hell yeah. Like, it was like full on. And he had given me kind of, you know, a caveat of, you know, let's talk about the legal side of this. Like, you know, let's have it business focused. Don't go crazy with like too much of the culture. Mm-hmm. But he really, they've given me a pretty long, you know, area to run. I mean, I can basically write about anything that isn't, you know, me distributing psychedelics, you know. I mean, they really allow me to do anything. So that's how I started moving into writing for Forbes about all psychoactives.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, it's just sort of a reflection of the sea change of things, that even that a movie like Fantastic Fungi, you know, definitely got premiered like all over the place, got people really interested. And then people like Michael Pollan's book, you know, for those of us who've been doing this for a long time, you know, like Michael Pollan's book is both like, oh, it's great because suddenly everybody's talking about psychedelics. And then those of us who've been in this area for a long time is like, well, yeah, we've all known all this, but I guess, you know, it took someone at that level, you know, because he's been a very popular writer. He's had very successful books. And I think it's also important having people like that in the field that, you know, not dominated by maybe the more fantastical side of things, you know, like certainly the most popular writer on psychedelics has been Terence McKenna, but for a mainstream audience, he's just going to come off as a bizarro. You know, he's talking about machine elves and UFOs, but here we have Michael Pollan, who's written books about food and, you know, really mainstream New York Times bestsellers. And then he comes in and says, well, this is an interesting topic that's worthy of exploring more. Right. And, you know, even my mom is like, have you seen this book by this guy, Michael Pollan, you know? And, and so it really opened up a mainstream area. And it's nice to see that places like Forbes are allowing you to help sort of continue with this and not clamping down and just like, no, this is a taboo subject that, again, it's really, there's a real sea change that's taken place.
There really is. Yeah. And I feel, you know, kind of like Michael Pollan in a way, you know, without the gravitas and without the fame, because I came to this late. You know, I'm a little bit late to the game, I guess you'd say. But I feel I'm doing this for the right reasons. You know, I'm really interested in the kind of healing of emotional trauma and just for a person's well-being to be able to discover these, you know, fantastic substances. And as I said to you before the interview, you know, I grew up during smack in the middle of the war on drugs.
Yeah.
In the 80s. And it was a terrible time. I mean, even though I bought a lot of the propaganda, it scared me, you know, into not wanting to try some of these things for a little while. I at the time was just like, boy, this is just a load. You know, why are people believing this? You could just feel that. So now I feel I'm at a place in my career. I'm at a place in my life. Like you said, the sea change is happening. I've got kind of Forbes behind me. I also write for Lucid News. So I feel like I have this kind of a little bit of a platform where I can help sort of turn the tide. I know that's kind of lofty to say that, but I feel like I can have a part in describing, you know, these medicines and just, you know, these helpful drugs, how they could help people, you know?
Well, I don't think that that's an overstatement at all, because I know, you know, I'm connected to a lot of people within the 5-MeO-DMT community, you know, obviously, but as soon as you started writing about this for Forbes, I mean, it was just all over my Facebook feed. Like, everyone's like, oh my God, did you see this? Forbes is writing about, you know, this guy, Dave Carpenter at Forbes is writing about 5-MeO-DMT. But like, what's going on here? You know, it was it kind of blew everybody's minds that because it is such a mainstream outlet that it was not what anybody expected. And so that was refreshing, and that, you know, those of us in the 5-MeO community have, even within the psychedelic community, some of us have felt kind of on the outside, because it is such a very powerful and somewhat different experience, and it doesn't have the same pedigree as, say, like ayahuasca or peyote or something like that, that it's a bit newer for most people, that it doesn't have these long-standing traditions. So yeah, when you were writing about it in Forbes, it definitely got everybody excited. And people were like, not only was it in my feed, but people were sending me links in Messenger on Facebook. And they're like, have you seen this? And check this out. And so it was all very surprising. And again, it's like my mom. Like, I don't know how my mom came across it. And I think even my dad. both of them, I mean, they're interested in my work. They're not interested in themselves experiencing psychedelics. So they're not part of the culture, or part of the world, but they're sending me links to your article saying, did you know that Forbes is writing about this, the same thing that you talk about? And
incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. And you know, Martin, to hear that is kind of shocking to me, because like I said, I'm in a little bit of a bubble and I'm not connected to the psychedelic kind of community. You know, I mean, I'm grazing it and hitting it in certain areas, but I'm, you know, I'm not a psychonaut. I'm not someone who's had, you know, a ton of trips, though I've had, you know, really expansive experiences. So to hear you say that is kind of blows my mind in some ways, you know?
Well, just so you know, I mean, when I posted to my social media that I was going to be interviewing you, I actually did have a couple people within the 5-MeO community say, oh, well, can you put me in touch with Dave? And I said, yeah, I'll talk to him about it when we have our conversation on Tuesday. So there's more people out there who want to talk to you that have been watching your work.
Well, that's very cool. You know, that first story that I wrote about the facilitator who had, you know, overcome social anxiety, and it was the first story that I wrote on 5-MeO. That was in February of 2020. I just looked at it this morning and it hit over 400,000 views.
Wow.
Like, it just I mean, I hate to be stuck on this views kind of mentality, but that's really a litmus, you know, and to see it take off like that and to take off inside of kind of psychedelic realms is also, it's really gratifying. I mean, it keeps me going when, you know, the pay isn't great. You know what I mean? I'm not making a ton of money with the books and stuff and with writing. But it's gratifying to hear that from you and to be on the show and, you know, to be just talking about this, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, it serves us who are, you know, sort of in the trenches of the community, in the sense that, I mean, nothing I've ever done has gotten 400,000 views or hits or anything like that. And so, yeah, to see it in the mainstream, to help, you know, educate the public, and not that we just want to completely normalize 5-MeO-DMT, because there's nothing normal about it, but just, I mean, I've been this big advocate of education, letting people know, you know, what is possible with these molecules, and particularly 5-MeO-DMT, so that then it's not this obscure thing. Like, you know, in one of our email exchanges recently, you know, I had mentioned how I first started publicly talking about 5-MeO-DMT in 2008. And at that point, even in the psychedelic community, most people had no idea what it was. And every time I said 5-MeO-DMT, people would say, "You mean DMT?" I'm like, "No, that's not what I'm talking about." And so, yeah, to have like Mike Tyson and Michael Pollan and, you know, other public figures be exposed to it and then have it be written about in mainstream media, I think that it's really helpful that it lets people know that there are these medicines. They are really powerful. And, you know, I think Mike Tyson is a great example where he really feels that his life has been transformed through it. And that's not to encourage everybody to go out and do it, you know, that we've got to be careful about this. But just as an example to show people that this is something that can happen with people. And then, like, even Michael Pollan in his book, he did not have a good experience with Toad, that he said that was like his least favorite thing out of everything that he tried. And I think even that is good in a sense, because there can be the tendency towards the over-glamorization of it, because people do have overwhelmingly positive experiences, but then other people have really terrifying, traumatic experiences. And so we don't want it to be just one-sided, you know, so to have both of these public figures. And then, to have that public awareness that, again, it excited everybody in the 5-MeO community when they're like, "Oh my God, this is in Forbes magazine. How did this happen?"
That's so good to hear. You know, you said a couple of things there, but that people should be careful. You know, I early on, when I listened to your podcast, right around that time, it was probably around 2018, I recognized that you weren't a zealot. And that really made me think, there's something about this specific substance that I need to look into deeper. And it was the interview that you had with Chad Charles. Mm-hmm. He was fantastic. I've actually interviewed him for my book, for the next book on Toad, on 5-MeO. And the two of you just sounded so, I don't want to say like a couple of regular people, but like you didn't sound to me like you were selling anybody on anything. That's I guess what it is. You sounded like you're just discussing in a really matter-of-fact way how this had worked for both of you and how it could work for other people. I don't remember exactly, but I'm sure there must have been some cautions in there that you guys had said, but it really struck me as, you know, a conversation that, I don't know, that I would have with friends of mine about, you know, buying a great car, or a conversation you'd have about a relationship that's working out or not. It was just very like human and personal and on the earth, you know what I mean? Like grounded, as opposed to like way out there in psychedelic land, which is a great place to be. But I think one of you said during that interview that we have to live, you know, we can have those experiences out there and bring back the information, but we have to live here in reality, you know, like, and that got me on the path. Actually, that conversation between you two got me on the path to specifically writing about 5-MeO and really thinking, okay, there's part of a book or a book in this topic.
Wow. Well, that's so awesome. It's so neat to kind of to find out these connections, because, you know, I'm very sort of insulated in my own world. You know, I put up my podcast. I have no idea who's listening to it or who's not listening to it. And I don't have like any mainstream media outlets or anything like that. And just to hear that it had an impact on you and that had an impact on what appeared in Forbes and that that's getting, you know, 400,000 views and all. I mean, it's great that there are these ripple effects that happen. And that's something that's kind of interesting about being in the psychedelic community, of seeing how these different ripples kind of move out and then where something pops up into public awareness. So I really want to talk about the whole book series, and we can come back to 5-MeO, but let's talk about the first iteration of the series of Your Neighbors Are Doing Psychedelics, MDMA. And it's a short book. I think it's a really great read. I think it's really great, especially as like an introductory book. It's the great, and I'm not trying to say that it's like dumb or simple-minded or anything, but in the sense that it's a great book to give to someone who maybe doesn't know a lot about the potential of psychedelic therapy, or people who might just poo-poo it or say, well, oh no, you just want to do drugs, that you go through sort of the history of MDMA, and then you follow this fellow Nick and kind of what happened to him. So I'd really like to talk about, you know, how you put this book together, and even just the title. I love it. Your neighbors are doing psychedelics. So maybe let's start there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. I think that's a high compliment, saying, you know, you sort of took it back, but this is a simple look at what psychedelics can do for people. So that's like high praise for me. And I wrote it to be kind of an introductory for people to start to accept that, hey, this is coming. You know, MDMA is very likely to be legal in the next year or two, and this could help a relative of yours or yourself, you know. So thank you for that introduction to the book. That, I love the way you summed it up. That was good. So the series was supposed to be one book that I envisioned about like six different substances. And I came up with that title after a dinner party at my girlfriend's cousin's house. I just brought up the idea that I was writing about this for Forbes, and it was kind of like, oh, you're writing about this for Forbes. You know, people tend to kind of stop and do like a double take.
Yeah.
You know, like, did I hear you right? Did you say Forbes?
Yeah. Did you really mean that?
Yeah. Did you really mean that? So I was like, yeah, this is happening. You know, this is something that shouldn't have ever been stigmatized and put into this kind of like only freaks use psychedelics and drugs in general. Actually, that was always just a scapegoat shitty situation. But I was like, you know, your neighbors are likely doing this, like right next door, you know, in Pacific Heights and, you know, San Francisco.
Yeah.
You can guarantee that that's happening, you know. And there, a few of them were like, oh, okay. And, you know, went on with the conversation, kind of went elsewhere, as it sometimes does. You know, it's like a kind of a difficult conversation for people that maybe only have, you know, a mushroom trip back in college to refer to, or just puffing a joint, and that was it as far as any kind of illicit drug. So the days following, I was like, I really need to put together a project of some sort. I don't know if it's a book, if it's, you know, a podcast, or if I'm interviewing people and just getting them up on Forbes in long form, because they'll let me just go. I can write, you know, a couple thousand words, or I can do a 500 word piece. And then I thought, no, I was talking with my girlfriend, like, I think there's like an actual book in this. So I started with a book and interviewing people about ayahuasca and, you know, just people who had maybe a lot of experience with psychedelics, some people that had no experience with psychedelics and were going down to Costa Rica and doing kind of, you know, the Gwyneth Paltrow kind of approach. Mm-hmm. You know, I interviewed the girl who is the main person in the documentary Dosed, who uses Ibogaine to get off 10 years of heroin addiction. I actually interviewed Frank McCaughey, who was on your show.
Yeah, from Shock to Awe.
Not from Shock to Awe, 5-MeO.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I interviewed the guy in Shock to Awe, one of the guys that was in that film. So I kind of was just grabbing anywhere I could, you know, people to write about this or to who would want to talk to me about this. And to a person, they were all not selling me on the experience. You know, and I don't know why I even had this kind of preconceived notion that people who are interested in psychedelics would try to sell me on it, you know, but maybe that's the idea that I had from kind of my 20s when I was sort of buying some of the drug war, you know, stuff. So I was really, you know, caught by the fact that these were just my neighbors who were trying to better themselves and trying to heal themselves. And one night that just hit me. Your neighbors are doing psychedelics, because it's kind of provocative. It's kind of like, you know, you realize they're doing psychedelics out there. And it's also like, give them a break. These are your neighbors that are doing psychedelics for a reason, you know, for expansion or well-being or healing. And I've mostly had people in the kind of so-called psychedelic community and people that just know nothing about it go, ah, okay, I get it. And I think I like it, you know, like the jury's out. But anyway, I was able to get the website and started up what I thought would be the book. And then you know how self-publishing can go. It's kind of hard, you know, to get the words out and then get the editing out and then get the marketing machine behind you and get the next person you're going to interview and, you know, all that. So I thought, well, I'm going to put out these, I guess you'd call them more booklets. You know, it's 18,000 words is what the first story is. I think it ends up being about 60 or so pages, whether you read it on, you know, a hard copy or digital. So I'm putting them out one at a time. And the MDMA one came about through Rick Doblin, who I became friends with and, you know, very worked with him quite a bit doing stories with MAPS. He introduced me to Nick Watchhorn, who is the focus of that MDMA book. Yeah. And that was just fantastic meeting him and writing about him. His story, do you want me to go into his story?
Yeah. But first, just a couple of things I want to comment on. That
sure.
Something that I really like that you said, that in talking to people, that they weren't trying to sell you on the drugs or on the experiences. And I think that that's often a misconception. I mean, there certainly are people out there who are very evangelical and also they want more clients or whatever. And, you know, everybody's got to do this. But I think that what comes up just again and again and again when you talk to people is that they talk about the impact that it had on them and their lives and the improvements that they experienced. And so often these conversations come with just a great deal of humility and gratitude of people just talking about their own experience. And they're not like, and so Dave, you've got to do it. I think you need this, but it's been so impactful for them. That's just like, my God, well, I had been suffering. And then I went and I did this thing and my suffering was transformed and lifted. And that, you know, a lot of people in sharing these stories, they start crying or their hearts start opening up and you can really see like, wow, this person has really been impacted. And that's sort of the real human side of the story. And it's not all the fantastical elements. And that's really what comes through with this story with Nick, is just really that human side. And something that I found very interesting, and I want you to tell us more about his story, is that it, within his MDMA experiences, something that seemed a little bit different there from things that I've seen elsewhere is that, you know, people talk a lot about sort of encountering feelings of love and feelings of forgiveness and feelings of healing. But Nick actually has quite a few like visionary scenes that play out, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't get talked a lot about particularly with MDMA, where, you know, we have this idea, well, it's a empathogen or a tactogen, and people don't really talk about the more visionary side of it. And in my own experiences with MDMA, it's not consistent, but I have found kind of similar to what Nick is recounting in your book here, that there would be scenes that very highly realistic scenes, not your normal, like, wow, everything's trippy, but like, no, this is just normal life in some way. And so that's something that really stood out about his story. But yeah, I'd love for you to tell us more about it and how you wove that together with the narrative of the therapy and Rick Doblin and MAPS and all of that.
Yeah, sure. That struck me as well, how much imagery there was. And how little people talk about that in relation to MDMA. You know, it's mostly the kind of tactile feeling that people have and kind of the love, you know, fest with someone else. Yeah, but Nick goes into some real cinematic kind of descriptions of what he's experiencing from childhood, you know. And let me back up. So I'm not great at this. Explaining this book, because I don't want to give so much away. So stop me if I'm giving too much away, Martin. Okay. I would love people to discover discover the story themselves. But Nick, first of all, I think it's important to say that he was a policeman in Australia, in Tasmania, Australia, in the mid-1990s, and was one of the first responders to the Port Arthur massacre, which was a single gunman shooting, the worst in Australia's history. 35 people were killed and 23 were wounded by one guy just loose in this little town. And this was just small town Tasmania, you know, rural kind of setting. So, you know, everybody knew someone in this town that was affected by it. And Nick shows up on the scene and the gunman is still loose, has this just horrific, you know, moment while he's trying to deal with, you know, his own potential harm that could befall him, as well as the aftermath of being on the scene and seeing, you know, all the destruction that that kind of carnage could create. So he goes through 20 years of his life, moves to California from kind of running from his problems. His relationship dissolves. He leaves his job as a cop. He loved his job as a cop. So it was like, you know, heart-wrenching. You could tell as he was telling me these stories that it was, you know, it was something that had just affected every single part of his life.
Yeah.
And he has horrific PTSD for 2 decades. And then just through, I think he says, changing healthcare plans in California near San Francisco, a psychiatrist who is looking at all his meds and stuff is like, what the hell are you on? Like all this stuff that you're on, I don't know how to deal with all of this that you're on. You know, let's get you off a lot of this. And then on the lowdown, recommends that he maybe looks into the clinical trials that are happening with MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, on MDMA specifically for PTSD. So Nick obviously finds his way into it. It's, you know, there aren't many spots available. You know, lots of people obviously are suffering, always have been suffering for decades now. And so I won't go like too much further into that. But I can describe how I came in contact with Nick. Do you want me to describe that or?
Yeah. And I just want to sort of emphasize the point that I think it's he makes a great subject for the book because he was a police officer. And again, it's kind of showing that sea change of that, you know, lots of people in the policing world have been very against changing the war on drug paradigm. But I think that is something that is starting to shift now as well, that there's a lot of people in policing who are recognizing that the war on drugs really has not worked. And then there also are people suffering from PTSD, you know, just like in the military. And that's why Rick Doblin really targeted the military for his studies, because he said, well, everybody has sympathy for soldiers, right?
That's right.
That no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, that you say, oh, we support the troops or we support the police.
Yeah.
And so that's actually a good entryway for other people to potentially be more open to the idea that this is a form of therapy and it's not just, quote, using drugs. It's not just escaping, but it's a form of healing.
Right. Yeah. Tactically, it was really smart for Doblin to do that. And he has since, you know, expanded into first responders. They've probably been doing this for a long time, actually, but, you know, firemen, you name it, EMT drivers, you know, I think there's actually conversations about prisoners, you know, trying to do some trials for people that are in prison. So they're having, and they're going to have a massive impact just like they did with Nick. I mean, Nick incidentally had never done an illicit drug in his life either. So, yeah. This was something also that's kind of shocking. I mean, he'd never even smoked a joint. And I mean, I was doing a Zoom call with him because it was right at the beginning of COVID and I couldn't meet him even though he was just like 10 miles away from me in the Bay. And I just about fell over. I mean, I was like, what? You have no experience. That's, to me, that was, like you said, a showing of a sea change, as well as like really courageous, you know, I thought, like someone to, you know, have faith, both in the system, you know, that is trying to help heal him and kind of faith in himself, you know. that he could handle it, or that he could change his viewpoints, which he had as a policeman, that were like, no to drugs, you know? So that was really striking to me, to have a guy like that as the sort of feature of my story. I knew he was going to be, you know, someone that people could be sympathetic to, could totally relate to. Also early on, he could tell that, you know, I have good intentions with this whole series. And before we got off that call, he said, I'd like to share something with you if you'll give me your email. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. You know, I thought it would maybe be a study or something, or, you know, I didn't really connect what it would be. And he said, I'd like to send you my personal journals that I wrote directly after each one of my three MDMA times, you know, that he, where he was actually on the drug. So it was cut up between therapy sessions before the first taking of MDMA, and then therapy sessions of, you know, three or four in between one and two, and then the second time of taking it. So it was a fairly long experience. So he sent me these journals, and I mean, the hair on my arm stands up to think about it. I read it, and I got to like page five, and I was sobbing. I mean, just like powerful, like really powerful, what this guy had gone through and the arc that he takes in his own introspection and looking through, you know, looking deeply at himself. It really set me on a course. I had already interviewed lots of people using lots of different substances. But this one hit me like deeply, that this guy would share, first of all, those personal journals with me and trust me like that, that he hadn't done any kind of drug before, that he was a cop. I mean, there were so many layers to it. And then that he exposed himself in such a way. It just like, I knew I had a winner. And that was the point when I started looking at those journals and then getting into the writing of that section of what was still going to be the book, Your Neighbors Are Doing Psychedelics, where I thought, I have to get out this first one in a shorter form, because MDMA is close to being legal, and I'd love to have people get this before it's there. You know, I'd love to have them already thinking about it and relating to a guy like Nick, who's right next door to him, you know?
Yeah. And I definitely agree with you that he makes a great subject, and his story is very poignant. And he obviously went through just a huge trauma as a police officer, and that he was willing to be vulnerable with you and with all of us by sharing his personal notes and journals. And, you know, like I say, we don't want to give away too much of the book, because we want people to read the book, and I really recommend people do. It's an easy read, but it's really worth it. One of the things that I really love is that, you know, with the therapy program, it's generally three sessions with the medicine. And I love how he was so surprised by the first one. And then, you know, because this is so classic, then the ego gets in there and he thinks, okay, well, I know how to do this now. And then his second one, he's just continually frustrated because he's trying to control it, because now he thinks he knows what he needs to do in order to have his therapy. And then the third one, he surrenders again. And just seeing that arc, because that shows up so often with people who are working at this therapeutic level, you know, and the therapeutic level, that's really different than just taking psychedelics for enjoyment or recreation, which I think is totally legitimate. But the therapy, you know, there's different concerns there, and that he demonstrates that in just such a very personal way. And so it's just makes for a very nice arc of the story.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm glad you feel that way. It's it was kind of more that I could ask for. Also the cooperation from Rick Doblin, who he might not say it, but he almost acted as an editor for me. I remember sending him off a copy of, you know, the not quite finished manuscript, or I don't know what you call a booklet manuscript. Maybe it's also called a manuscript. And I was just beat. I mean, you know, 18,000 words isn't a book, but it's a lot of words to write, you know, and there's a lot happening there. And I cracked open a couple of beers and started painting. I love to paint, just, you know, on a canvas. And boom, I see a call from the area code that I know is his area code, and he wants to talk to me about it. He's read it. He's gone through it in like 1 hour, you know, he's maybe 2 hours, he's read it. And I was like, oh man, okay, I've got to talk to him about this. And he spent a good, you know, hour on the phone with me, discussing certain angles of his own experience and parts of his life that I had, you know, historically spoken about to get it more correct, and adding to it the history of MDMA with Merck. You know, he just helped me kind of fine tune. So as you mentioned before, you know, intertwined in the story, in Nick's story, is kind of the, and a sort of abbreviated, quick-ish history of where it was first synthesized and kind of how it made its way, you know, to Rick Doblin getting behind it with MAPS. Alexander Shulgin, of course, you know, kind of resurrected mm-hmm. it at a certain point. So I hit all these key points that I hope people will, you know, go back and maybe take a deep dive into all these little pieces if they want to, because again, just like Nick's story is cinematic, Shulgin's cinematic, and the story of MAPS is like its own. You know, there's going to be a documentary, I think, on Doblin, and there's got to be a movie in it in 10 years. You know, it's what he went through fighting the DEA and suing the DEA 2 times.
Yeah.
You know, it just like it's really crazy. I mean, it was wonderful writing this first book that was like a kind of nice encapsulation of MDMA for, you know, the kind of every man and every woman who could be open to using these drugs for whatever purpose, you know, even if it's a night out, you know, dancing, they can be a lot less afraid, you know, and use it to their advantage. Like we use everything to our advantage, cars and, you know, yeah. heavy power tools, right? Like all these things, you know, it's a cliche, but you can cut your arm off with a saw or you can cut a piece of wood. It's not afraid of the saw, you know, it's, so I hope this book can, the first book can do that for MDMA. And I feel that it can do it for 5-MeO too. Yeah. The next one. Yeah.
Yeah. So is then the idea you're going to continue on with the same title? It'll be Your Neighbors Are Doing Psychedelics. And then the next one will be 5-MeO DMT, or?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm a good way through the, you know, research and compiling and writing of this next one. There's a lot of me in the second one because it's me. A lot of this story is my kind of coming to psychedelics again after, you know, a lot of years of not having very many experiences, and then finding 5-MeO. I mean, the way that I found it, I had said to you earlier in emails, you know, there was this real intersection of, you know, kind of synchronization that occurred to get me onto this topic. So when I keep trying to write this without me in it, I'm like, well, what about that thing that got me in that way? You know, try to put me in there. So I'm considering it will be part of the Your Neighbors Are Doing Psychedelics series that I'll put somewhere, you know, on the cover. But I'm thinking about calling this one just simply Toad, you know, for kind of marketing purposes, potentially calling it 5 and I. That's kind of a catchy title. Yeah. That I was like, I don't know. I don't know. If you have any suggestions, I'm up for them. I haven't landed on a title yet, or it's not in concrete what the story is just yet, though there is a key person that I talk about. There are several people that come into the story who've used it to great success. There's all the clinical studies that are happening like crazy everywhere. You know, public companies that have gone public just in the last, like one that went public in Ireland a month ago that specifically is working on 5-MeO DMT. There's a lot to this story that's kind of a similar format to the MDMA story. So it's still kind of bubbling in my head.
Yeah. Well, I just want to support the idea of it being okay for you to be in the book too, because that's also part of sort of the contemporary narrative right now with a lot of people now being exposed to more the therapeutic or the mystical side of psychedelics, the spiritual religious use of psychedelics, that this is now a phenomenon that's happening for many people, you know, where they say, well, yeah, you know, I took LSD or mushrooms, you know, a long time ago in high school or college or something like that. And now people in their 50s, 60s and 70s and even 80s that now suddenly their interest is turning to this again. And
right.
You know, even with the older people that they're thinking like, wow, well, you know, maybe I want to have an experience like that before I die. And so
yeah,
just having you as your own personal narrative of how your interest got drawn into this world, I think that a lot of people will see that reflected in their own experiences. And just like with Nick, the cop, who's like never did anything, but then had this therapy and has been powerfully impacted by it, that's all part of the story, that it's not just the people who've been doing this their whole lives and have always been interested in it, but that this is part of what's happening in culture, that there is this rediscovery. And sometimes for people it's brand new. And for others it's, well, yeah, you know, I took acid back in college, but it was never a spiritual thing. It was never a therapeutic thing, but I'm interested in these other aspects of it that are, you know, becoming part of the legitimate, marketplace of both ideas and practices and products. And this is why I also think that it's totally legitimate that you're writing all of this for Forbes, because, you know, sometimes people get really kind of uncomfortable around the topic of money and, you know, what's going to happen as therapies become legal. But
yeah,
you know, I mean, we live in a capitalist society. There's going to be money involved. So
right,
we should be talking about it.
Yeah, it's the natural course. And if you're talking about it, you can perhaps have a part in creating it, you know, or moving it in a certain direction, or being a part of the money making, right?
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Everybody needs to make money.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you have to pay rent. So, you know, while I'm not like mining, you know, to make millions of dollars with this, I'd love to make some money, you know, like be a part of this thing that's happening. It was interesting. I was invited to, I have been invited, you know, maybe in the last few months, to kind of seminars and online conferences with investment banks.
Yeah.
And like some really big names that I signed any NDA agreements, so I can't talk about it, but it just blows my mind listening to some of these conversations. And there's, you know, you're sort of typical investment finance guy who 2 years ago would have, the word psychedelics would have just stumbled off his lips. Like he couldn't say it without feeling like, who's going to come for me? You know,
yeah.
Am I going to get busted even saying it? And now, you know, they're tossing out these kind of like buzz terms about how to monetize it. And tempered by, just recently I've seen MDs in this discussion, you know, like, is it Carl Hart? Carl Hart is a guy that I really love, but yeah. Carhartt Harris.
Yes. Yeah.
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 Yeah. He, you know, obviously is involved in a lot of this, you know, people at that level, like Yale and, Johns Hopkins, that are already talking about the, you know, it's going into a medical place and into a real capitalist kind of place where, you know, the people tend to make, are going to be looking at how to make a lot of money out about with this. But this guy said something that really struck me. He was talking about the demedicalization of this. So it'll go medical and it'll go into that capitalist, you know, kind of realm, but it will probably fall back because of equity problems. You know, you don't want this to become all medical or mostly medical where only people of means can afford it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's going to cost you $20,000 to go through something like Nick went through. So this term demedicalization, I had never heard. And it was described like just economies of scale to like, for big companies to get these ideas out there, it has to fall back probably into a spa-like or a massage therapist or, you know, people that are trained to give the medicine, but not an MD, you know, not necessarily a psychiatrist or even a psychologist, you know, someone who has a good amount of training. And therefore, that means the average person will find it a lot more affordable than the likely medical route that would be thousands and thousands, you know?
Yeah. And that's hopefully what we're going to be achieving here in Oregon with the psilocybin services initiative, that it's not the requirement that you be a doctor or have a medical facility. It is going to be required that you have specific training and that you have, you know, safety protocols and all sure. of that. It's still in the development period, but that's one of the goals also, is to make sure that it's affordable and accessible and that it's not just some kind of elite treatment, but that anyone can have some kind of access to it, because, you know, you don't need to be suffering from crippling PTSD to get benefit from one of these experiences, you know?
Right.
You
yeah.
And that there should be room for people who want to explore personal growth or creativity, or, you know, why not? A day at the spa includes a journey deep into the mind and the yeah. recesses of the universe, you know, that can be refreshing, just like getting a massage.
Sure.
Can. And, you sure. know, it's just listening to you talk about, you know, the high financiers and all of them talking about it, that, you know, one of the barometers I like to use is mainstream entertainment. And on this last season of Billions, when, you know, we've got Axelrod, whatever his name is, you know, yeah. talking about wanting to monetize ayahuasca and bringing a shaman up from South America, and, you know, how are we going to get this ayahuasca product out there? And it's like, okay, well, obviously people in high finance are talking about it. If this Showtime show of Billions yeah. is dealing with psychedelic medicines, that obviously they're conversing about this already.
Absolutely. Yeah. That struck me too. When I saw it, it was like, wow, it's arrived. And, you know, I'm part of the machine to make it arrive. It sort of hit me after that, like, wait a minute, I you know, probably had a part in this. Very interesting.
Yeah. Cause people writing the show Billions, I'm sure they read Forbes. They must.
Yeah. Yeah. They must. I know a guy who's a producer, and they just comb the internet for interesting stories and sell those ideas to, you know, directors and writers and, you know, other companies. So it's highly likely, you know, that happened in that way.
Yeah.
It's really something. It's something to be a part of this. It's exciting. Every day I think about this. How can I, you know, this next book, how can I make it really impactful? And I have to say, you know, the Substance 5-MeO is so fascinating and dynamic, and the people involved in it, you know, like I've said to you before, are these interesting characters. And I got to say it again, it's like, it's cinematic. I mean, to me, and I hate to bring it to kind of like a Hollywood term, but it's like really good film. You know, some of the scenes that people lay out for me, leading up to their use of 5-MeO and what it's done for them afterwards, I'm just like sitting on Zoom calls with people, like, well, hanging on their next words. You know, it's fun. You know,
yeah. So that is going to be the next book. So then, beyond that, are you still envisioning this as being a series, and then looking at specific medicines and molecules, and just kind of keep going with these same sort of threads of weaving in personal stories, the research, the finance side, the medical side, bringing all these together?
I am, yes. So ketamine is the next one that I thought I would write about, but I've been doing a little bit of research, more research on mescaline, and thought, is that one ready to kind of like pop in the next couple of years? Have you heard about some of the studies that are happening?
Not with mescaline.
Oh, this yeah. kind of just happened. So there are studies that are happening in Switzerland. I think it's the University of Basel, however you say that. They're looking at side-by-sides of psilocybin, LSD, and mescaline. And MindMed is kind of connected to it somehow. They will have access, and I believe own the data that comes from it. So they're looking at how to create novel psychedelics based on mescaline, and kind of, you know, what do they call it? It's like an analog. They're very interested in it. I wrote a story for Lucid just last week. So I interviewed the chief medical officer, Dan Carlin, at MindMed. And he couldn't say a whole lot, but in the next few months, this is going to be kind of gurgling up, I suspect. Hmm. So, you know, mescaline has an incredibly rich history. I mean, it's got, you know, the Navajo Indians, of course, Native Americans. I mean, yeah. it has a similar, I think Park Davis instead of Merck were the ones that kind of synthesized it to begin with. And then Merck took it over. Like it just has a lot going for it. Those could be the next ones that I look into. I have a whole lot of interviews and data on ibogaine, like I said, with the woman who was in the film Dosed, psilocybin, LSD. I've just been talking to people all over the place, so I've got just sort of like word files full of these conversations and interviews that I've done. So I'm not positive what the next one is. I'm really hoping that the MDMA one will catch a little more fire. Yeah. And the one on 5 will then kind of continue the momentum. And I could see that there's even an interest out there, because currently, again, I'm just in this bubble and I'm like, am I only talking to people who, for instance, would be your average listener on your show, you know, that's already kind of interested in this kind of topic. And you may have people that, you know, sit outside of that. You may even have a lot of people that sit outside of that psychedelic community, but I wonder who I'm affecting out there. You know, like I just don't know. So the first two are going to be kind of testing the water.
Yeah. Well, that's where I'd really like to plug again, this first one, your neighbors are doing psychedelics, MDMA, that I think it's just such a great read for anyone who like has a family member or a friend or someone who has either poo-pooed psychedelic therapy or is on the fence or thinks it's all just nonsense, that this is a great read for that particular audience. And then even, you know, someone like myself who is deep in the psychedelic movement, I loved the book. I was very happy to read it. And
thank you. That makes me so happy.
Yeah. So that it really hit a lot of really important points. And so I think that even someone who's deep in it, you're going to get something out of it, but it's one of these bridges, sort of this bridge book that you could give this to someone who doesn't know anything about it. And they'd walk away saying, wow, I think this is important.
That's a nice way to say that. I might need to get that quote from you.
Okay.
To put on the book. you just made me think of something with the word bridge. I think that's what might be my kind of part in all this that's playing out with psychedelics, kind of bridging the gap between the what would be your typical Forbes reader and these very useful substances. I feel like I'm maybe like a translator, even though I'm not someone who can talk deeply about psychedelic experiences necessarily. I mean, I have had quite a few, but I feel like I can talk to that person who's the finance person or who's just downright afraid of what they might uncover in their own psyche. And it's like, I don't want a part of that, you know, that I could maybe bridge that gap and make an introduction and kind of, you know, across the aisle kind of conversation. That's sort of like accidentally where I've sort of found myself, whether I consciously did that or not, you know, going from cannabis to, first of all, writing about cannabis and then moving into all psychoactive drugs. That's what ended up happening. I act as that kind of intermediary, you know, so it feels like a nice position for me to be in.
Yeah. So just in getting back to Forbes, do you, as a writer for them, do you have like a requirement of how many articles you need to submit on a month? Or is it just when you have a subject, like with this case with this woman, Christine, whatever her name was the other day.
Yeah.
Who smoked a toad. is it, do you just get to submit an article when something pops up into the field that you say, okay, I'm going to write an article about this? Or do you have, you know, deadlines and quotas that you're supposed to meet during the month? I'm just curious about.
Yeah, that's a question a lot of people ask who are curious about the writing side. I can write as many articles as I can pump out around the clock. So there's really no maximum. They would love me to put out more, and there's no minimum. There is a kind of pricing structure that they have, where if you hit a certain amount, you get, you know, a certain bit more. But I can literally, as long as my stories are, you know, well thought out and link out to, you know, NCBI and Hopkins level kind of research, you know, I quoted you in that story.
Yeah.
It's in the Christina Hawk story. If I continue to do that, I can just write as many as I want. And incidentally, I'm my own kind of editor too, and proofreader. So yeah. Like, you know, I've worked for 25 years as an editor and writer. So I'm meticulous about rereading my stuff and making absolutely sure that I've, you know, dotted I's, crossed the T's. So they kind of just let me go for it, which is a really nice, you know, setup for both of us. It's a great mouthpiece for me, and they get me to write, you know, as many stories as I feel like writing.
Yeah. And that would be definitely one of the benefits of sort of the internet age, that I know that a lot of print magazines have really suffered because of the internet age. But now, since you want online content, or I should say that the magazines want online content, and you're not limited to, well, they only have so many pages in the printed version. And so,
right,
you know, we're going to limit what we put in there. And now, if it's all going to be online, then of course, that if you're writing articles that are getting lots of views, well, then have you write more of those. So it really opens up that freedom in a way to really pursue this and keep putting it out there, not being worried about, well, is this going to be cut on the editing room floor because there's not enough room, or it's off
right.
topic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had plenty of stories in print where, you know, someone asked to, they got a late ad in, a full page ad right next to my story. It's like, sorry, 1,000 words just went down the drain. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. So in some ways it's, you know, difficult to deal, you know, the pay is not as good as it used to be. But I really can use it as a platform to reach a lot of people, who otherwise might not hear about this topic, you know?
Yeah. So let me just ask you a question about being a writer. That
sure.
Obviously you're reporting, right? You are compiling information, you're reporting, and you're, you know, writing your booklets or your booklets, whatever we want to call them. You're writing your articles. Do you ever delve into writing fiction? Is that an interest of yours, or do you like reporting just the facts, ma'am?
You know, I do like fiction. I do like to write fiction, but I'm not very good at it, unfortunately. So I've tried a few times, and it hasn't worked out. So I'm strictly the kind of reporting nonfiction. Though I will say, I kept the first book, MDMA, kind of straight reporting style. You know, it was kind of AP down the center.
Yeah.
And the next book, because I get to include myself, I can take some of those, you know, like in fiction, you're able to kind of stretch out a little, you know, and sort of use your writing muscles a little more in different areas, kind of have some fun with it. And I feel like including myself in it, even though it's still nonfiction, I'm still writing about real things that happened to me. I can write about it in maybe a more kind of dynamic way and get that fiction kind of Jones that I would love to have.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I'm just always curious about other writers and, you know, what they're into. And, you know, I myself love writing fiction, but my audience is, you know, it's for the nonfiction works that, you know.
Right.
So I like writing novels, but they hardly ever get read.
Yeah. What is your fiction about?
Well, that's actually where I started. Is it was when back in 2002, I was teaching one term at UC Berkeley, and I had just finished reading The Silmarillion, The Hobbit, and The Lord of the Rings. I mean, literally, I just finished reading it, and it was like on a Tuesday night, and I was like, you know what? I think I want to write my own fantasy epic. So then I just started writing it, and it became a 4-book series. And kind of took everything that I learned from graduate school and all my interests in mushrooms and Salvia divinorum. Those were the two psychedelics that I knew at that point in time. And from my field work with the Mescalero Apaches in New Mexico, and kind of wove all of that into this fantasy story. Then more recently, wrote a novel called Beyond Azara, which is sort of based on when I first encountered 5-MeO-DMT and then was also going to the Santo Daime Church locally and drinking ayahuasca. And so it's kind of about, you know, like doctrine and dogma and ritual versus individual freedom, you know, but it's also a love story. And then my most recent novel is just from a few years back now, and it's called The Solendarian Game. And it's a futuristic novel about an artificial intelligence that was developed by a reformed Buddhist association that got involved with the use of 5-MeO-DMT in order to reach nirvana, and they create an artificial intelligence that becomes the future Buddha, is known as Maitreya, and completely restructures human society and then spreads people throughout the galaxy. And so it's this, you know, this epic tale of this rogue avatar that tries to, you know, destroy this world. Anyway, there's a lot to it, but the shorthand is it's toads in space.
Oh, okay. I'll have to for sure check it out. I really enjoyed your entheogenic liberation. Did I get the title right?
Yeah.
I like your writing style. In the nonfiction stuff, you really bring it down to, you know, like I said in your podcast, to a very real place, like this very ethereal, you know, ineffable topic. You bring it down to reality in a way that's really, really enjoyable for me. So I'll check out your fiction.
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, I try and write about the same things in the novels, mm-hmm. and just put it into a story form with characters, you know, kind of like what you're doing here with Nick in the MDMA mm-hmm. book, but just put it into a psychedelic fiction sort of context that, you know, the few readers that I have who do branch over into my fiction, they usually come back and say, well, I was amazed because you explained all the same stuff, but it was in a story, you know, and they're surprised. It's like, well, yeah, that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Write about what you know too.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, Dave, it's been really great talking to you today. Where can people find your neighbors are doing psychedelics, MDMA?
Yeah, so they can find me at my website, which is yourneighborsaredoingpsychedelics.com. There are ways to get to the Kindle store to buy the book there. You can also get a hard copy through them. There are links to contact me if you just want to, you know, drop me a line or ask me a question or whatever. I have a link for pre-ordering the 5-MeO book, so people can do that. That's the best way to catch me.
Great. And any articles in the work at the moment, or we'll see what pops up in the field?
Yeah, I have to think about that. I've got one on Dr. Carl Hart, who wrote Drug Use for Grown-Ups. Awesome book. He's a Columbia University professor. I'll be interviewing, actually I've already interviewed him about testing at events, having facilities available to, you know, test substances for harm reduction. So I've got that coming up. There's a 5-MeO story that I've got too that's escaping my mind. My mind was so laser focused on this interview. Sorry, I'm kind of out there. They can also just Google me at David E. Carpenter Forbes, and all my stories pop up under my author page if you're interested in reading anything I've written.
Yeah, well, that's how I ended up reaching out to you. That I just typed in, David Carpenter, Forbes, and then I found your picture on Forbes, and I'm like, oh, there's no email link, and I dug around some more, and then I found your neighbors are doing psychedelics, and that's where I ended up contacting you.
But, nice.
Yeah, but it's been great to connect with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing about your experience in this world of high finance writing and psychedelic drugs and therapy, and really looking forward to whatever happens with the 5-MeO book and, of course, whatever comes next for you. And so let's just stay in touch. And, you know, as books come out and come back on the podcast, we'll talk about it some more.
Oh, I'd love that. Martin, thank you so much for having me on. It was just a total blast. You're so easy to chat with. So I appreciate that. Appreciate you a lot.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave.